Good evening, for afternoon, morning, I don't know, what is this? It's good to see everybody out. I think I remember how to do this. Appreciate all the prayers last week. It is good back, so good to see some that I haven't seen in quite some time back here. I've always had a face for radio, and now I think I've got the voice that kind of matches the face, so bear with me. We're going to continue on our series on King David. I think sometimes we have the tendency to think that everybody else's relationships are better than mine. I think especially in this day of social media, it's easy to feel like everybody else's life, everybody else's family are healthy and happy. Everything seems to be going well for them. And you say, I bet nothing ever goes wrong for them. I bet they always get along. And that kind of sometimes makes me feel like I'm the only one that loses his temper, the one that says things that they shouldn't say or regret. But the truth is, and we know this, whether we acknowledge it or not, is that almost every family has something, some issue that they are dealing with, some topic that has become too painful to deal with, something that has been going on maybe for days or maybe for years or any times in between, something that has caused tension. Maybe it's something that hasn't even been discussed. Maybe it's even so bad that two or more people in a family or friendship have quit speaking to one another. Again, maybe for weeks or months or maybe even years. And almost every family is dealing with some issue or topic that hurts. And sometimes what I'm afraid is that happens is that people feel like church, that being part of God's family is only for people, or only for families that have everything all worked out. That there are people, and maybe you or someone you know or love feels like that I am not worthy to be there. I'm not worthy to be a part of this. That church is only for people with good families, or families that don't fight, or families that don't argue, or families that don't have issues like ours. Have you ever felt that way, or known somebody that has felt that way, or currently feels that way? That church is only for people who have it figured out. But you know what dispels that myth better than anything else? It's the Bible. Because there are few families that have as deeply rooted or as big of issues as some of the families that we read about in the Bible. I would argue that that's exactly what 1 and 2 Samuel and 1 and 2 Kings is all about. It is to remind the people of Israel, the very first readers of this, as they are reading this, with the story ending up with them in captivity, in exile in Babylon, for them to be reminded that, yes, our family of Israel is deeply flawed, but we can still be faithful to God. God still wants your faithfulness. You are not beyond repair. You're not beyond reconciliation. Whatever has happened, whatever has gone on, whatever it is that you have failed to do, it can be put back together, and you can still be faithful to God in spite of your flaws. And the family of David specifically is one of those families that if you think just for a second that your family has problems, just look at David's family and you will know that you are not the only family that has flaws. So let's just think about David's family for just a second. We talked about a couple of weeks ago when I was up here, David's sin with Bathsheba. And then after that, in 2 Samuel, everything seems to become unraveled. Almost the next story after David is with Bathsheba and Nathan the prophet shows up, you have this story that's really just too horrible to describe with David's son Amnon and his son Tamar. Amnon takes advantage of his sister Tamar, and then David doesn't apparently really do anything. I mean, he's mad, but there doesn't really seem to be any discipline. And so his other son, Absalom, he takes matters into his own hands, and he murders his brother Amnon. This horrible thing happens, and it's followed up with one brother murdering another. David has lost two sons in one day, one by death and one by exile, because Absalom knows that he can't come home after he killed his brother. And so he goes to his mother's homeland of Geshur, and he hides in exile. And let's look at 2 Samuel chapter 14, verse 1. It says that now Joab, the son of Zeruiah, knew that the king's heart went out to Absalom. Well, that's got to be a real understatement, doesn't it? This is dad, and his son has murdered his other son, but he still loves his son. But he really can't, because he's the king. Everybody expects justice to be served. What's going to happen here if David says, forget about it, come on back home? On the one hand, he thinks, I'm the king, and this is what has happened is wrong. But on the other hand, he says, I love my son, and he longs for him. And Joab knows that the king is longing for his son. And so Joab sent to Tekoa and brought from there a wise woman and said to her, pretend to be a mourner. Now, remember, keep in mind, she is pretending. All the words she is going to say, the story she is about to tell, all comes from Joab. And he tells her, put on mourning garments. Do not anoint yourself with oil, but behave like a woman who has been mourning for days for the dead. And I kind of can't help but read this story and think about the one we talked about last time. Nathan tells David this fictitious story about a man who stole another man's lamb, and it kind of seems like all of David's friends have to trick him into doing what he needs to do. But this woman goes to David, and she tells this story that Joab gives to her. He says, go to the king and speak thus to him. So Joab put the words in her mouth. When the woman of Tekoa came to the king, she fell down on her face to the ground and paid homage and said, save me, O king. And the king said to her, what is your trouble? And she answered, alas, I am a widow, and my husband is dead, and your servant had two sons, and they quarreled with one another in the field. There was no one to separate them, and one struck the other and killed him. And I wonder, as this woman is bowing down before David and saying, I am in a desperate situation. My husband is gone. The only thing I had left are my two sons, and they were out in the field, and they were fighting with each other, and one has killed the other. I wonder, when she says this, does David think to himself, I know exactly what she's going through? Because he's got the exact situation going on in his life. But maybe the story is just different enough that David doesn't immediately see the connection. And now the whole clan has risen up against your servant. And they say, give up the man who struck his brother, that we may put him to death for the life of his brother whom he killed. So they would destroy the heir also. Thus they would quench my coal that is left and leave my husband neither name nor remnant on the face of the earth. The clan is doing what is legally permissible. That brother that is still alive is a murderer. And the law says that the murderer can and should be put to death. The clan is going after the living son, and maybe to connect it to David's situation, David is thinking, this is probably what should happen to Absalom. On one hand, Absalom probably should be put to death for murdering Amnon. But yet on the other hand, this mom is like, you can't let that happen. He's my only son. He's my only heir. He's the only son of his father who died. This would kill our family. You can't let this happen. And so there's this tension between justice and mercy. Something has been done that is wrong. And so on one hand, you say justice must be served. But on the other hand, there's this love of a parent for their child and their desire for them to experience mercy. So verse 8 says, "The king said to the woman, 'Go to your house. I will give orders concerning you.' And the woman of Tekoa said to the king, 'On me be the guilt, my lord and king, and on my father's house. Let the king of his throne be guiltless.'" Now, why would she say that? Why would she say, "Don't let anybody put the blame on you"? Because what David is saying here is, let justice go undone. I'm having mercy on him. Nobody is going to kill him. And she says to him, if there's guilt for this, let it be on me and not you. And so the king says, if anyone says anything to you, bring them to me, and he shall never touch you again. And then she said, please let the king invoke the Lord your God, that the avenger of blood kill no more, and my son be not destroyed. He said, as the Lord lives, not one hair of your son shall fall to the ground. When it comes down to that, to justice or mercy, which side does David land? Mercy. He says, nobody is going to kill your son. He says, if they do, they're going to have to answer to me. Nobody can deal out retribution for what has happened. I'm landing on the side of mercy. And I kind of want to pause right there just for a second. What's going on is interesting. On the one hand, David has his own situation with his own son, who is in this distant land and not coming back and not having a relationship with his father because what has happened, he's sort of carrying out justice, but there's this implication that if Absalom were to come back, there would be a trial and there would be a death because Absalom is a murderer. Yet now, David is dealing with someone else's kid, someone else's family, and he doesn't land on that side of retribution and justice. He lands on the side of mercy. Do we ever have a tendency to do this? To be more merciful with someone else's family than our own? We tend to be more merciful when it comes to someone else and someone else's situation than the one we are in. When we're in a situation, we think, no, justice has to be done. This was done. This was wrong. This shouldn't have happened. And I'm not going to have a relationship with you. I'm not going to talk with you until justice is served. But when it's someone else or their family or someone else's situation, a lot of times we say, let's get this behind us. Let's reconcile. Let's what's done be done. It's really easy to be more merciful to someone else's family than it is our own. And that's exactly what is going on in this situation. Verse 12, the woman said, please, let your servant speak a word to my lord, the king. And he said, speak. And the woman said, why then have you planned such a thing against the people of God? For in giving this decision, inciting with mercy, inciting with her son instead of the avengers, the king convicts himself. Inasmuch as the king does not bring his banished one home again. David here has this chance to rule on behalf of the son or on behalf of the avengers of blood, and he comes down on the side of the son. He comes down on the side of mercy, and the woman wisely turns the situation and says, but do you see in your own situation? You are siding with the avengers of blood, and you are convicting yourself. You're saying what's right in my situation is mercy should prevail rather than judgment. What should happen is forgiveness. What should happen is reconciliation. But yet, she says, you convict yourself because that's not what you're pursuing in your own family. In fact, by depriving the nation of their heir apparent to the throne, you're depriving the nation of their family. Just as I've been deprived of my son, so you're convicting yourself. And then verse 14 is one of the best verses in the Old Testament. We must all die. We are like water spilled on the ground, which cannot be gathered up again. And that's packed full of lots of truth. It's just a profound statement. And then I wonder, what does she mean by that? How is she applying that to this situation? We must all die. And when we die, it's like water being spilled that can't be gathered up again. And lots of commentators have lots of ideas on what she means. Maybe it's a combination of all of them. Maybe she means, David, you're going to die. I'm going to die. We're all going to die. And if we don't take care of what needs to be done now, eventually it's going to be too late. Maybe Joab has sent this woman to David to talk to him, to get him to bring Absalom back home because he knows things needs to be made right before David dies. Maybe Joab is thinking David's getting up in years and at any point David could die. And if David dies without an apparent to the throne, it's not going to be good for anybody. So you need to take care of things while you still can. There's a lot of truth to that. You need to take care of things while you still can. Maybe she means like Absalom is consigned to die. We're all consigned to die. Like he's been convicted of wrong and he's going to die. We're all going to die. But she does go on to say that God doesn't really want that, that he doesn't relish our death. Maybe she means that, or maybe she means by death, she's reminding us of Amnon, the one who was murdered. Maybe she's reminding us that he can't be gathered back up again. Maybe she's reminding David that we're all going to die, and when we die, it's like water spilled on the ground. You can't gather it up again. What's done is done, and it can't be fixed. There's no way to gather that water back up, and that has a lot of application. When I mess up, I haven't murdered anyone, but most of the time it's my mouth. It's the words I use, the things I say or choose to say that I shouldn't. I've said something about somebody or I said something in the heat of a moment. It's similar. It's like water being spilled on the ground, or it's like it's real easy to get toothpaste out of the tube, but have you ever tried to put it back in the tube? It's impossible. If you pour water on the ground, there's no way to pick it back up again. But sometimes when we're in a situation, it's almost like we expect the other person, maybe even the one who did the water pouring, that we expect them to put it back in the jar. And we're like, I'm not going to have a relationship with you until you put the water back into the jar. And guess what? It can't happen. Nothing Absalom can do, nothing David can do will bring Amnon back to life. Just like the crime that Amnon committed, nothing can undo that. Nothing can fix it. And if you are expecting by holding on to your grudge, by holding on to this animosity, by keeping the person estranged, that somehow that is going to put the water back in the jar, you are going to be sadly disappointed. Nothing you can do will put the water back in the jar, and expecting the other person to be able to do it is in vain. It cannot be done. If this relationship stays estranged because you are waiting for them to fix something that cannot be fixed, you will be waiting forever. But listen to what she says next. This is the reason you should be reconciled with Absalom. But God will not take away life. And he devises means so that the banished one will not remain an outcast. Why should you be reconciled to Absalom? Because that's the sort of thing God would do. And I can't think but help of who are the first people reading this story. 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, it was written for a banished, exiled people. To say this is the sort of God our God is. He's the sort of God that brings back banished people. What's done cannot be undone. What's been spilled cannot be gathered back up again. The people that are dead, they can't be brought back to you. You can't fix what is broken, but that's not going to stop God from fixing his relationship with you. That's not going to stop God from devising ways to bring you back home again. Can you imagine how encouraging and how comforting that would have been for those Babylonian exiles to read those words, that this is the kind of God God is? He's the kind of God who devises ways to bring the banished ones home, that they won't stay estranged from Him. And then I think about us, but before we were Christians, we were the banished ones, cut off, estranged from God, but through Jesus, we've been reconciled. I think of Paul's words in Ephesians 2, about verse 12, he says, "Remember that you were at times separated from Christ, alienated from the commonwealth of Israel, and strangers to the covenants of promise, having no hope and without God in the world. But now, in Christ Jesus, you who were once far off have been brought near by the blood of Christ." This is why you should pursue reconciliation. Not because the water can be gathered back up. Not because what's broke can be fixed. Not because anything, but that's because the kind of God God is. That our God lands very much on the side of mercy, and that He devises ways to bring the banished ones back into the family. And I wish I could say right here that David listened to the woman and they all lived happily ever after. But you know we can't. If you keep reading, you know what happens. David brings Absalom back. He listened to some extent. He brought him back to Jerusalem, but for 2 years, he wouldn't allow him back into his presence. Absalom was back in town, but he was held at arm's length, and it drove Absalom crazy. In fact, he said, "I should have stayed in Geshur. If Dad's not going to let me back in the house, why? Why did I come back? I should have just stayed away." And finally, David does let him back in his presence, but I don't know. By then, maybe the distance has become too much. For whatever reason, Absalom conspires to take the throne away, and the story continues to unravel. And I say all that to say, reconciliation is messy. It's hard. It's not easy. It's not just saying you should do it. Be reconciled with whoever you're holding at arm's length. It's really easy when we read Jesus' words that if you're offering your gift at the altar and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there at the altar and go. First be reconciled to your brother and then come and offer your gift. Those words are simple to say. Go, first be reconciled, but they are very hard to do. It's a very messy process. It can be heart-wrenching. That's why we don't do it, right? That's why we sit here and say, "I need to make that phone call. I need to send that text. I know I need to apologize. I know I need to accept that apology. I know, but it's hard." Yes, it's hard. That's why we don't do it. Because it's easy. We do it. We don't do it because it's easy. We do it because that's what God has done for us. He has devised a way to bring the banished one, you, me, that we might not remain estranged from Him. He brought us home in spite of what we did. There is no way to undo what we broke. But Jesus said, "I will go. I will be the means, the way for the banished ones to not remain outcast." He brought us in, and because that's true, then at the same time, we respond to that reconciliation by one, being reconciled to God, but we also do our very best to be reconciled with each other. So here's what I take away from this story. Is don't let the things that can be fixed or can't be fixed, don't let the things that can't be fixed keep you from fixing the things that can. This virus, there is nothing that we can do to fix it. But we can't let it stop us from fixing the things that we can. I've said things, you've said things, your family, your friends have said things that can't be unsaid. Man, I wish they could. As soon as they exit my mouth sometime, I say, "Why did I choose to say that?" But don't you know that the people that you've said painful things to and they've said painful things to you that are hurtful and painful, they probably think the same exact thing. And insisting on them fixing what can't be fixed means never being able to be reconciled. Instead, we need to recognize, I can't fix this, and neither can you. But I want to pursue reconciliation anyway. Not because it's easy. Not because it's not messy, but because that's what Jesus has done for us. Because God has devised a means for the banished ones that we might not remain outcast. So let's not worry about the things we can't fix, but let's work on the things that we can fix. There are so many things in our life that could be fixed if we would pursue them. Things that would get better if we would pursue them. Seek peace. Seek unity. Seek reconciliation. To seek a better relationship, because that's what God, through Jesus, has done for us. Yes, we are a flawed people, but we can be faithful. So maybe this morning there is someone here and you're ready to put Jesus on in baptism. Baptism is all about reconciliation. We are cut off, estranged from God. But through Jesus, we can be reconciled to God. We can be united with Him in baptism. And maybe you've decided that today is that day. Or maybe you need prayers. Maybe we can pray for you or encourage you to have the courage and strength to pursue reconciliation. No matter whatever the relationship you have. Or maybe you just have a lot on your heart. And we can pray with or for you. See myself or a deacon or an elder following service, or please come now as together we stand and we sing.